Okay, so the title of my talk, Quid Est Veritas, refers to Pontius Pilate's question to Christ and John's Gospel. Of course, it's hard to say what exactly Pilate's intentions were in raising this question, what is truth? Perhaps it was to absolve himself of any of the consequences of his actions. Perhaps it expresses his skepticism that truth is really all that relevant to the deeply pragmatic and compromised political decisions he had to make, including the judicial condemnation and execution of what he took to be an innocent man. Or perhaps it's just a deep skepticism that anyone can, as Christ says, bear witness to the truth. But however we interpret that scene, one thing is certain. Pilate's question is a perennial and personal one for all of us. It has not, and it will never, go away. It's a question that we will inescapably confront again and again, precisely because, as rational animals, that is, creatures with an intellect and will who make judgments, assertions, and choices, we cannot avoid seeking what is objectively true. The truth is inescapable for us because even if we try to say that there is no objective truth, we are thereby trying to say something objectively true. This reality about us that we seek out and must conform ourselves to the truth in every sphere of human life is what all forms of relativism, which is the denial of objective truth, attempt to deny. Now, why should we worry about relativism? Students in my classes, especially my classes in moral theory, which I teach often, are often scandalized by the idea of making truth claims. The tacit assumption that they bring into my class is that making moral judgments is a little bit presumptuous, illiberal, and worst of all, unkind. Of course, the intelligibility of their objections to making moral truth claims depend upon very serious moral truth claims of their own, namely, that it is truly bad to be illiberal or unkind, that humility is truly good, that it is truly good to respect one another's life choices, and so on. I will return to this point later on in the talk. For now, I want us simply to notice the following interesting fact, that the principal reason to adopt moral relativism in the first place, which of course is the idea that there are no objective truths about what is good or bad human action, depend upon moral beliefs that are taken to be objectively true. This self-contradictory stance is the first sign that something's a little bit off with relativism. But perhaps the worry is deeper. Perhaps relativism is worse than just unserious or insufficiently reflective. Perhaps it is positively bad for society and needs to be guarded against. This is the position of Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, certainly. In his homily to mark the beginning of the conclave that would eventually elect him Pope, then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger warned that, and this is on your handout, we are building a dictatorship of relativism that does not recognize anything as definitive and whose ultimate goal consists solely of one's own ego and desires. Now, Ratzinger's marks are a bit cryptic, and they're certainly very dark. Obviously, a dictatorship sounds pretty bad. Sounds like something we don't want to be building up unawares. But why would Ratzinger call relativism a dictatorship? If relativism is the idea that there is no objective truth, such that all opinions are basically on a par, that sounds pretty democratic and tolerant, the exact opposite of an authoritarian dictatorship. And moreover, in a liberal democratic society such as ours, which takes its citizens to be free and equal qua citizens, each with an equally important vote, and therefore an equal right to determine the future course of things, it might initially seem like relativism is the only foundation for a truly liberal order. One might wonder then, doesn't Ratzinger have it backwards when he claims that the relativist is the ego-driven tyrant? Rather, isn't the real egoist and oppressor the one who claims to have possession of the truth? Isn't the claim to possess the truth a claim to possess power over others, namely the ones who do not possess it? Isn't the appeal to objective truth intrinsically hierarchical and undemocratic, a potential threat to individual liberty, autonomy, and personal authenticity? Isn't it a better vision for society to encourage everyone to speak their own truth, as Oprah implores us to do, and to live according to our own authentic vision of life? In this talk, I'm going to suggest that a truly liberal democratic order, one that preserves true freedom and equality among its citizens, depends upon mutual recognition of and respect for objective truths, most especially objective truths about the nature of us as human beings. Relativism is a genuine threat to freedom so understood, and Ratzinger was correct, I think, to associate it with a kind of despotism. So to show this, or to begin to try to show it, it's a big claim, I will first go through a variety of kinds of relativisms that one might encounter these days, especially here at a university, arguing that each version is both problematic and deeply unappealing. And then along the way, I will say a few things about what I think truth is, generally, why truth is inescapable for us as rational animals, and why truth is necessary for a proper account of freedom, the kind that a liberal democratic order is supposed to secure for us. Okay, so this section is just called Varieties of Relativism. Not all relativisms are equal. Some are easier to knock down philosophically than others. But let's begin with the most vulgar form of relativism, the sort of thing that well-meaning people sometimes say but I think don't really believe. This is the sort of relativism that is often attributed to the sophist Protagoras. Protagoras is a guy that we know about simply because Plato talked about him. Now, being called a sophist is not a compliment, so as you can imagine, Plato was not a fan of Protagoras. Protagoras's idea, roughly, is that there is no such thing as an objective measure of truth independent of us, so that there is no way to adjudicate between your own beliefs and anyone else's. For example, Jane says that global temperatures are rising due to greenhouse gas emissions. Jack says that the current warming trends are part of the natural order of things, and that greenhouse gas emissions have made a negligible contribution to the current upward tick. The relativist comes along and says there is no truth of the matter either way, because there is no way things really are that could serve as a measure that determines which belief, Jack or Jane's, is more accurate. They're both totally fine and equal. We have to be careful here because relativism isn't just disagreement. Genuine disagreement depends on the idea that there is some objective truth and thus something to disagree about. Relativism also isn't the skeptical claim that we cannot be certain about our access to reality, that the evidence is too complicated or tricky. Relativism is the much stronger claim that each belief is equally true or equally good qua belief. The world is as it appears to you, and the world is as it appears to me. But that's all that there is, mere appearances. Or if we like to talk about reality, there's your reality and my reality, but we needn't think these realities will converge upon a single reality independent of our individual perspectives. And even when they don't converge, there is no real possibility of disagreement between rival perspectives. Now, the problem with this view is that it is self-refuting. So suppose that you go to study under Protagoras, and he tells you all about relativism. Why is he telling you this? Presumably, he's trying to teach you something he believes is true. If he did not think he had a truth to share with you, then why would he be teaching? There are other ways to take your money. So it's obvious that, whether he admits it or not, Protagoras thinks that relativism is true and not simply for him. And he has to think this. Otherwise, believing in, asserting, and teaching relativism to students would be pointless and absurd exercises. Protagoras' theory is self-refuting because its content is at odds with the nature and purpose of theorizing in general, which is to put something forward as true, that is to say, as something other right-thinking people ought to believe. So if he went to Protagoras and objected and said, no, relativism is totally wrong, he would presumably argue with you and not just walk away. Okay, so to defend these claims, I should say more about truth in general and how it relates to judgment, assertion, and belief. Okay, so traditionally philosophers have thought of truth as the way things are. So in this sense, truth has an ineliminable reference to being. Now, if you think about propositions, which are the judgeable contents of judgments, assertions, and beliefs, something like, it's raining now in Anchorage, Alaska, these things are either true or false. So it either is the case or it's not the case that it's raining now in Anchorage. I don't know. So I don't have a belief about it either way. But the way things are right now in Anchorage is going to settle whether anybody's belief is good or bad. Now, Aquinas thinks that truth is not simply the way things are, but the way things are in relation to some intellect. The intellect, or the capacity for knowledge and understanding, relates one to being by way of truth. So a judgment or belief is good or bad if it's true. And for it to be true is to relate a person to reality in the proper way. So for instance, to know that there is a podium here, let's call this a podium, is to be related to the podium in a certain way. As Aquinas says, it is an adequatio, an equation between the intellect, right, the judgment in my mind, and the thing, the res, the reality. Okay, so if I believe some proposition P, that is to take P to be true. That's just what it is to believe something. To assert something is to say that this is the way you take things to be. That's what assertion is. Now, Aquinas, I think, would agree with the contemporary philosopher at Harvard, Richard Moran, who argues that belief is transparent to the truth. What does that mean? That means that from the first person perspective, I treat the question of my belief about P as equivalent to the question of the truth of P. Now that means that if I'm deliberating about whether to believe that it is raining now in Anchorage, I just am deliberating about whether it is true that it is raining right now in Anchorage, which just is to deliberate about whether it is the case that it's currently raining in Anchorage. So when I'm trying to make up my mind from the first person perspective, I am trying to figure out the truth. That's just what I'm doing. To see how close the connection is between belief, truth, and reality, consider the following scenario. Imagine someone thinking to himself as he looks out the window that it's raining, and then conjoining this with the thought that he doesn't believe that it's raining. This doesn't seem possible. For this reason, Ludwig Wittgenstein, in his very famous Philosophical Investigations, argues that if there were a verb meaning to believe falsely, it would not have any significant first-person present indicative. It just wouldn't make sense. So to believe something is to have settled the question for oneself about the way things are. Of course, I may be wrong, but to believe something is to make a claim that can in principle be correct or incorrect, and the measure here is truth, the way things are. From the first person perspective, the commitment to something beyond my own psychology is unavoidable. To believe and to judge is to transcend one's own perspective. It is to put oneself in relation to things and to be held accountable to them. For this reason, Aquinas says that truth is that towards which the intellect tends by its nature, and that it is through intellect that we are open to reality. For Aquinas, truth is a relation between two terms, the thing or the being and intellect, our capacity to judge or know. I think we can think of truth in this sense as something along the lines of what another Harvard philosopher, Christine Korsgaard, calls a constitutive principle, one that both defines and measures the activity that is the intellect. So truth, as the constitutive aim of belief or judgment, both defines a belief as what it is, a believing just is and aiming at the truth, but it also provides a measure of whether the belief is good or bad, because a belief is good if it's true, and a belief is bad if it's false. So as thinkers, believers, and asserters, we cannot escape the truth. We are naturally and inescapably oriented towards truth just in virtue of having an intellect, in virtue of being a rational animal, something that knows. So we cannot turn our backs against the truth without thereby rejecting what we are. Okay, so we can apply these ideas about truth back to the global relativism that we're considering. A view that, by the way, has never been popular among philosophers, and probably now you are in a better position to see why that's the case. According to the global relativist, everyone's beliefs are true, but in a private sense. But now I hope you can see that the idea of a private truth, of one's own personal truth, is unintelligible. To make a judgment, form a belief, or to assert something is to do something essentially public. Even if I never share my belief with anyone else, it still has an essentially public character because belief makes a claim about the way things are independently of my perspective upon them. So in judging, asserting, or believing, I am holding myself accountable to the world, which is a publicly accessible thing. You have access to it as well. Therefore, if you say you believe that there is no absolute truth, no way that things really are, this amounts to saying that you don't believe in belief. But of course, to say that you believe that there is no belief is to have a belief and to take a belief that belief about belief is true. This is obviously to be caught in a nasty web of self-contradictions. Okay, so that's my shtick about the self-defeating nature of global relativism. The relativist cannot help but assert his relativism, and in so doing, he cannot help but take it to be true for more than just himself. Okay, so global relativism seems pretty hopeless, but maybe you don't want to sign up for that. Maybe you just want to be what I will call a partial relativist. So people may think that what they read in their chemistry, physics, and biology textbooks are absolutely true, or at least that there is some reality that could determine whether the claims in these books are true or false, but that there is no absolute truth to be found in a book on ethics, politics, or aesthetics. So I'm writing a book on ethics, and such a person would think, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man, and leave it there. Obviously, someone could think that there are truth makers relative to some domains and no truth makers relative to other domains. In this latter sort of domain, all perspectives are equally valid because nothing objective exists to adjudicate between rival claims. Now, this kind of view, so the view that, you know, there's no objectivity with moral judgments. It's just everybody's opinion, and everybody's opinion is equally shiny and special. That view would not be self-refuting. But that doesn't mean that the view is any good, okay? Not being self-refuting is too low a bar for a theory. I'm going to discuss some versions of moral relativism and give you some reasons for thinking that this is really no good. Okay, but before I talk about what moral relativism is, I think I should say something about what it isn't, because there can be some conceptual confusion here. So moral relativism isn't moral skepticism. The moral skeptic doubts our claims to possessing moral knowledge. But this is not the denial of objective truth. It's the denial about our ability to have any reliable access to it. So that's a slightly different claim. And moral skepticism is fascinating, but that would be a different talk. Alternatively, a skeptic might think that all that is going on with rival moral claims is just a statement of one's preferences, such that there is no agreement or disagreement to be had. So you have your preferences, and I have my preferences. Preferences aren't truth act. They're not susceptible of being true or false. So if I say, well, I really like chocolate ice cream, and you say, nah, it's totally gross, you're not saying something that's true or false. You're just stating what you like. So it's a completely different, and if you think that rival moral claims are like that, again, you're just skeptical that this is an area in which we have any knowledge. And again, that's not relativism. The moral relativist just wants to deny objective truth. And she just wants to deny it in the specifically moral sphere. So in the moral sphere, there are only private or personal truths. So Lucy thinks that rape is impermissible. She thinks that's true, whereas Linus thinks that rape is permissible. Both are true according to the relativist. That is to say, it's true from Lucy's perspective, and it's true from Linus's perspective, and that's just kind of all we get. Now, one thing that's really weird about this point of view is that it can, in principle, have no practical upshot. Because as soon as one tries to make moral relativism practical, that is to say, as soon as you try to implement this view in action, one is caught in a kind of performative contradiction. So, for instance, suppose you're at a frat party and you see Jack trying to rape Jane, who's only semi-conscious. Thinking that rape is wrong, you will, of course, try to stop him. But you cannot try to stop him if you are an ethical relativist, because you will have no ground on which to do so. After all, you are committed to the belief that Jack's value judgments are true for him and equally as good as your own. And Jack doesn't think that rape is wrong. Perhaps he thinks it expresses his will to power. Perhaps he thinks so long as he has drugged the woman he rapes and makes sure that she doesn't get pregnant, that he really isn't doing anything bad to her at all. Let us suppose you are a decent person, and so you're pretty horrified by what Jack is doing, and you're pretty horrified by his beliefs too. As a relativist, however, you have undermined any ground you might have otherwise had to object to Jack's behavior or intervene. As an ethical relativist, you cannot in principle impose your belief, your truth, on someone else, since they have their own beliefs and their own truth, and they are just as special as yours. At best, you can say that what Jack does is upsetting you, but of course, Jack will only stop if he cares more about your well-being than his own sexual gratification. But Jack doesn't really seem like the kind of guy that puts others' needs before his own. I mean, think about what he's doing to Jane. So hopefully you can see the problem. All this is to say that the ethical relativist can only be a relativist in theory and not in practice. That's pretty weird, because we typically think that our ethical beliefs are supposed to translate into action. They're supposed to be practical. I mean, there's something pretty off with the person who says, yeah, I think I shouldn't steal, and then they're busy stealing your laptop. Something is wrong with that person. And I think that, similarly, something would be wrong with the ethical relativist in the case that I described. So it looks like the only time that it is possible to be an ethical relativist in practice is when my actions only concern me. Because only then would I not be imposing on anyone else and trying to realize my own private vision of the good. I think it's pretty hard to identify actions that only affect you, if not impossible. Certainly if you find any, they're going to be few and far between, because most of what you do either directly involves others or it affects them downstream in fairly obvious ways. Okay, now this point about the practicality of moral judgments is important, so I want to dwell on it a little bit longer because I think it brings out the connection between truth and goodness. So I've already argued that we cannot escape making judgments, beliefs, and assertions as creatures with an intellect. This is just our plight. We have to do it. But we are not merely knowers. We are also actors. And so we also have to deliberate from a first-person perspective, not just about what to believe, but about what to do. But just as the question about what to believe is transparent to the question about what is true, so also the question about what to do is transparent to the question about what is good or truly desirable. When we choose some action in some circumstances, we choose it because we think it is in some sense good, either that it's pleasant, that it befits me, whatever my status is to do that sort of thing, or that it's instrumentally useful to the attainment of some other good that one is trying to secure. Alternatively, we choose some action because we think that it avoids some evil, where avoiding evil is just a way to maintain or preserve one's good. So, just as the intellect orients us to the truth, the will orients us to the good. For this reason, Aquinas says that the will is a rational appetite. It is a capacity or tendency to pursue or go after what the intellect judges is good. But no one wants to choose what is merely apparently good for him or her. People want things that are really and truly good for them. Now, this is true even of really bad people, morally bad people. So according to Aquinas' theory of vice, where vice is the opposite of virtue or a disposition to act well relative to some domain, even the most vicious person is after real human goods. So for instance, the greedy man is after wealth. Wealth is really good. The trouble with the greedy person is that he just wants way too much of it only for himself. But that doesn't mean that wealth is bad. The lustful man is after sex. Sex is a real human good. It's just that the lustful man is a little out of control. And so on. You can go through all the vices in this way. So again, from within the first-person perspective of human experience, of deliberating, practically making choices, and acting, moral relativism looks like it is a denial of a central and inescapable aspect of our experience. And this is because the moral relativist holds that there is no such thing as objective goods for human beings to seek in their choices. But then choice itself starts to look impossible. For if choice isn't about getting on to real goods, why choose anything at all? Or why go after anything? The very act of choice seems to depend on the thought that you can secure a real good for yourself, perhaps even a good life on the whole. Okay, so the fact that ethical relativism is deeply impractical and implausible certainly undercuts the main motivations for adopting it in the first place. If we adopted relativism because we are practically committed to advancing values like freedom, equality, and tolerance, we have now found ourselves in the awkward position of being unable to advocate effectively, if at all, on behalf of our lives, and equally unable to realize our most basic values as relativists. Because as soon as we tell someone else that they need to be tolerant, we're contradicting ourselves. So if tolerance, freedom, and equality are really goods, then they are truly goods. And things that are really and truly good ought to be realized in our individual and collective actions. We should arrange our lives and our societies so that we can secure and maintain such goods. But relativism effectively blocks this. And when we see this, I think it becomes increasingly unappealing. But the fact that it's unappealing isn't really a direct argument against ethical relativism, because sometimes the truth can be really unappealing and shocking. So we need a different line of argument if we really want it to go away. We can note that many people come to affirm moral relativism because there's so much moral disagreement, both within a culture and across cultures. So these people think that the fact that there is no agreement is a sign that there is nothing to agree about, no objective truth that really cuts across cultures. And this disagreement isn't recent. It's kind of a fixture of human life. Certainly the Jews and the Romans profoundly disagreed about how to live, about what it was okay to do and say, and what wasn't. So the ancient historian Herodotus, who was writing in the mid-5th century BC, relates the following anecdote to the king of Persia. This quote's on your handout. He summoned the Greeks who happened to be present at his court and asked them what they would take to eat the dead bodies of their fathers. They replied that they would not do it for any money in the world. Later, in the presence of the Greeks and through an interpreter, so that they could understand what was said, he asked some Indians, who do in fact eat their parents' dead bodies, what they would take to burn them. They uttered a cry of horror and forbade him to mention such a dreadful thing. Okay, so this is a famous quote that people often use to say that Herodotus was one of the Greeks who accepted a kind of relativism. Now, I think insofar as we take Herodotus to be putting forth a view here, and not just simply relating an anecdote, the view would be what we now call cultural relativism. So I think that you can think of cultural relativism as a species, a variant of moral relativism, insofar as it says that morality is relative to cultures. And on that view, it's shared cultural beliefs and practices that determine what is morally true for the people who are born into that culture. So what's morally true for an Aboriginal tribe in what is now called Australia is true for them, but it's not true for we Americans, and vice versa. A version of cultural relativism was put forward in 1947 by the American Anthropological Association in direct response to the UN Declaration of the Universal Rights of Man. Okay, so the AAA was against such a universal declaration on explicitly relativist grounds. They argued that moral values are relative to cultures, and that there is no way of showing that the values or customs of one culture are superior to any other. And if that is true, it is a mistake for Western political institutions to impose their ideology of universal rights on other nations. The anthropologists dared to pose the following question to Western Europeans and North Americans. How can the proposed declaration be applicable to all human beings and not be a statement of rights conceived only in terms of the values prevalent in the countries of Western Europe and America? The anthropologists worried that a declaration of universal human rights was just colonialism masquerading itself as universal justice. It was the ideology of the white man's burden all over again, just in a different guise. So instead of declaring a regime of universal rights that all cultures around the world had to respect, the anthropologists argued instead for, quote, respect for differences between cultures, which is, quote, validated by the scientific fact that no technique of qualitatively evaluating cultures has been discovered. The anthropologists also claimed explicitly that standards and values are relative to the culture from which they derive, so that any attempt to formulate postulates that grow out of the beliefs or moral codes of one culture must to that extent detract from the applicability of any declaration of human rights to mankind as a whole. So these are all direct quotes from a sort of manifesto that was published in the American Anthropologist, which I guess is the journal of the AAA. Okay, so the first thing that I want to say about this fascinating document is that its appeal to science is simply embarrassing. For just as there is no scientific way to determine ethical value, there is also no scientific way to determine that science is the measure of all forms of knowledge. To say this imports philosophical assumptions that would need a ton of justification that I think probably has no justification, but at any rate that the anthropologists certainly don't supply. So, setting that aside, here we have the familiar refrain to respect diversity rather than interfere and impose, because moral and political standards are relative to cultures. And to fail to recognize this is to evince a kind of crude parochialism. This does not have to assume, by the way, that other cultures have to respect diversity as well. So it needn't be self-defeating in the ways we have already discussed. There is something of a complication here in that the document actually does talk about a so-called right of man to live in terms of their own traditions, but I'm just going to pretend they didn't say that. Because they didn't need to say that. The main thrust of the statement is that within our Western culture, we should respect diversity and be tolerant. That should be a value for us. That we should not continue on the sad and sorry legacy of colonialism. And so we shouldn't interfere or impose. This will mean, by the way, that women will continue to be treated as inferiors to men and denied political rights, education, and any semblance of control over what happens to their bodies, that honor killings may continue, or any other number of things that look like moral atrocities from a contemporary Western point of view. The consistent cultural relativist will just bite the bullet here. They'll say, yeah, you know, you can't do that. Now, I want to take cultural relativism very seriously, even though I think it suffers from similar problems that we've already seen bedevil moral relativism. But here's an actual example that helps to make the problem of cultural relativism more concrete. So in this wonderful little essay called Trying Out One's New Sword, Mary Midgley describes the following custom of samurai warriors in medieval Japan. This is also in your handout. There is, it seems, a verb in classical Japanese which means to try out one's new sword on a chance wayfarer. I have no idea how to pronounce this Japanese word, but it literally means a crossroads cut. A samurai sword had to be tried out because, if it was to work properly, it had to slice through someone at a single blow, from the shoulder to the opposite flank. Otherwise, the warrior bungled his stroke. This could injure his honor, offend his ancestors, and even let down his emperor. So tests were needed, and wayfarers had to be expended. Any wayfarer would do. Okay, so what interests me so much about this example in particular is that it brings up another kind of relativism, a relativism that is related to moral and cultural relativism, but is tweaked in a slightly different way. And following the philosopher Bernard Williams, I will just call this the relativism of distance. So this is the idea that we can't judge the past. So Williams was deeply skeptical that we could judge past cultures, even previous cultures within the Western tradition. So it wouldn't just be that we can't judge, you know, the medieval Japanese, but we also, you know, can't judge the ancient Greeks. Williams thinks that our moral beliefs and our culture are radically contingent. So it would be a mistake for us to think that we have any authority to judge those who came before us, when things were very different and contingently so. So going back in time and judging the past is basically an empty and vain compliment to ourselves for managing to be so wise. So Williams would be deeply skeptical that we can judge slavery in the ancient Greek world or even here in the antebellum South, or the mores and actions of the kings and clerics of, say, Louis XIV's ancien regime. In short, Williams argues that appraisal of the past does not satisfy two conditions for genuine ethical judgment. One, we cannot claim that our judgment and the outlook supporting it are inspired by interests or concerns that people in the past would have recognized as their own. And two, that appraisal of the past does not concern a practical question about what to do now, and so it's an empty gesture. So what can we say to Williams or to our benighted anthropologists? Is it true that we should refrain from judging our medieval Japanese warriors? I think this is a really difficult question. And so I can't answer it in a very simple way, but I will say a few things that I think should guide our reflection on this question. The following seems certain to me, and that is that adopting relativism doesn't solve the vexed problem of our relationship to the past or to other cultures. It arguably just makes that relationship more strained. For one thing, if we adopt relativism in either sense, it makes learning from other cultures and time periods very difficult, because if I cannot censure another culture, I also cannot praise it. For that, too, would be to make a moral judgment about it, which I have blocked myself from doing. Now, if I were seriously to engage another culture or another time period, I would need to ask critical questions from my own perspective. So in thinking about the medieval samurai warriors, we would want to ask why the practice was intelligible to them. What goods hung on it for the community? Who benefited from it? What was lost if the practice was abandoned? How do non-samurai feel about the practice, the chance wayfarers? They might have felt very differently, right, than the warriors did, but maybe they didn't. Maybe, like, I honestly don't know, but maybe being a chance wayfarer was a totally cool way to go. Does consent matter? Like, or do we all kind of tacitly consent that maybe we're a chance wayfarer? What is the value of life in such a culture? In order to enter into a genuine dialogue and exchange with another culture or time period, we have to be able to say what we find good and what we find bad in it. If we cannot do this, then we have no hope of converging on a shared worldview. We have no hope for genuine cultural exchange or any hope from learning from the past. But that kind of dialogue, the sorts of questions that I'm posing, can only take hold from a place of real commitment, right? A commitment to my specific values. I can't make those sorts of inquiries from any other place. So insofar as relativism asks us to give up our commitments and to suspend them, it asks us to be dishonest, and it invites the bad belief that we have nothing in common with these other cultures, which I think is a false belief. But it also strips the past of its ability to make us more alive to our own problems and our own failures. And again, I think this sort of cuts off the past from us in a problematic way. Okay, so since I'm running out of time, I want to return now to our opening remarks about relativism being a dictatorship. When all truth is relative, which really means that there's no objective truth at all, a vacuum is created. As previously mentioned, we all have beliefs and we all have choices to make. In absence of any public criteria of truth, which can determine which of our beliefs or choices are good or bad, some beliefs and some choices will still have to prevail. This is inevitable because we are humans and we will always live in human societies. So some ideas have to win out and some values have to be pursued. So somebody's vision of the truth and the good is going to prevail. And if we don't have objective measures of truth, which are based on publicly accessible criteria and are in principle available to anyone, then all we have left is a kind of will to power. The powerful will impose their beliefs on others, and the less powerful will not be able to make recourse to rational arguments. So freedom and equality, I think, really do depend on truth. They really do depend on some publicly accessible measure out there. And so we were wrong to think that relativism is a friend to democracy and equality. Quite the contrary, it is, I think, their enemies. For truth helps us to transcend ourselves. Without truth, we collapse into ourselves, and it really does become all about our own egos and desires, and a kind of will to power, right? To hold our vision over others. I think this brings us to another great danger of neglecting the truth, one that is neglected by Ratzinger, but which is discussed by David Foster Wallace in a variety of his writings. This other danger that relativism invites is cynicism, alienation, and a kind of detached irony. David Foster Wallace rightly diagnosed this self-referential and ultimately alienated condition as stifling and oppressive, as offering us no solutions, as leaving us focused only on ourselves, and even then in a deeply detached and cynical way. This cynicism and apathy is a ripe environment for a totalitarian authority or so-called strong man to gain power, because there won't be the necessary will to fight it. And then I have this great David Foster Wallace quote on the handout, which I won't read because it's terribly wrong, but I will just say that he conceives of this sort of irony as a sort of fear, of being truly human, right? Of allowing yourself to feel these kind of truly human things. Okay, so let me just close with some ideas about what I take true freedom to be. So Father Pinkers, who is, he's dead now, a Dominican in moral theology at Fribourg, wrote a book that I highly recommend called The Sources of Christian Ethics. And in that book, he discusses two conceptions of freedom. The first he calls freedom of indifference, and the second he calls freedom of excellence. On the first conception, the will is simply a power to choose, and this choice comes prior to any judgment of reason. It's a kind of liberty of indifference. You can just choose options. Whereas on the latter conception, free will is freedom to choose the good and avoid evil. And this choice essentially depends on a judgment of reason. The first sort of freedom is indifferent. It is mere choice without fundamental orientation to true human goods. Whereas the second is a rational attraction to the good. Only the second sort of freedom is defended by Thomas Aquinas. And only the second sort of freedom, I think, is a freedom worth preserving. Because it's a freedom to fulfill our nature, to flourish, to find happiness as human beings. This kind of freedom is the essence of the moral life, and it's denied by the relativist. But I think to deny this freedom is to deny our nature. So I'll just leave you with that.